Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present investigative journalist Robert Parson, who examines the U.S. military's use of unprecedented quantities of depleted uranium weapons in the war against Afghanistan and the possible consequences for public health. Sally Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action, who assesses the distressing set of problems facing the people of the African continent. And Dan Seligman, Director of the Sierra Club's Trade Program, who discusses the North American Free Trade Agreement's Chapter 11 provision, which compensates corporations for their loss of profit triggered by government regulation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Financial Times reports that aid agencies working in the Sudan are demanding international protection against government attacks on civilians near oil fields in the war-torn southern part of the country. In recent weeks, the Islamic government in Khartoum has renewed its attack on Christian rebels in the south. For their part, the rebels, which have recently merged two rival factions, are attacking Western-owned oil production facilities. One company, Swedish-based London Petroleum, has suspended oil production out of security concerns. Moreover, the Bush administration has halted peace talks in Sudan after a government attack killed 17 people at a food distribution site. Oxfam's Vincent Gainey says that reports of new attacks by government forces against civilians in the Upper Nile region have caused possibly 200,000 people to flee the area. Laura Milo of the United Nations World Food Program says the Sudanese government imposed a ban on aid flights near oil pumping complexes, denying access to 300,000 people in the oil-rich region. Yet there are talks between the UN and the Sudanese government to allow food aid to be distributed in the war-torn southern Sudan. Meanwhile, Canadian oil giant Talisman remains undeterred. The energy company continues to pump 200,000 barrels of oil a day out of Sudan, ignoring threats from rebels. The human cloning debate is back on Capitol Hill. The U.S. Senate has just held hearings on banning the cloning of human embryos, either for medical research or to create new human life. The cloning debate typically pits social conservatives and anti-abortion activists against scientists and people seeking cures to chronic diseases. But as The Nation magazine reports, anti-biotech activists are now teaming up with conservatives, as evidenced by a January statement signed by 67 progressive thinkers who endorsed the ban on cloning human embryos. These biotech critics worry about the powerful markets that may emerge for human eggs, and that new research will create unhealthy incentives for women to undergo questionable hormone treatment or surgery. The principal concern for activists like Jeremy Rifkin of the Foundation on Economic Trends is that cloning will be the first step in creating a new biological marketplace, where cloning is an act of production, not of creation. Already, leading life science corporations have leapfrogged the congressional debate by patenting human embryos and stem cells, giving the companies ownership and control over this new form of reproductive commerce. Rifkin claims this is a form of biocolonialism, in which global life science companies become the ultimate arbiters of the evolutionary process itself. Mother Jones magazine reports that former Enron chairman Ken Lay put away a personal nest egg over a year before the $70 billion energy trading giant collapsed last fall. In February 2000, Lay and his wife Linda, who recently made a plea of poverty on NBC's Today Show, purchased $4 million in variable annuities that will pay the couple a yearly income of $900,000 starting in 2007. Texas law protects these funds from recovery efforts from former Enron employees and stockholders. Several financial advisors told Mother Jones that the Lays likely bought the annuities when they did as protection against such possible future lawsuits. Once the annuities mature, the Lays will get payments of nearly $76,000 a month for life. Gideon Rothschild, head of the American Bar Association's Committee on Asset Protection, says that depending on the facts of the case, a court could seek to freeze the annuity payments by finding an exception in view of the amount involved and the finding of Ken Lay's culpability for fraud. Meanwhile, Kelly Kimberly, a spokeswoman for the Lay family, refused to comment on the couple's finances. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Major news outlets reported recently that the Pentagon is in the process of developing new nuclear weapons and tactics for use against U.S. declared enemies such as Iraq, North Korea, Libya, or China. One element of the planning calls for the development of low-yield nuclear weapons that will be capable of destroying underground bunkers built to protect an enemy's command and control centers. Over the past decade, the U.S. military has used depleted uranium munitions in Iraq and the Balkans to destroy tanks and other shielded or hardened targets. Deep-penetrating depleted uranium-tipped shells or warheads burn extremely fast and hot, enabling projectiles to easily destroy heavily protected targets. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert James Parson, whose article titled "The Big Lie About Clean Wars, The Reality of Depleted Uranium," appeared in the March edition of the French publication Le Monde Diplomatique. In the piece, based on the research of Di Williams, Parson reports on the U.S. military's unprecedented use of large quantities of depleted uranium in the war against Afghanistan and the possible public health disaster which it may produce for both civilians and combatants.
The article is built around a recent report that Di Williams has just brought out, and it's entitled Mystery Metal Nightmare in Afghanistan with a question mark. And the reason there's the question mark and the reason that he calls it mystery metal is that in all his research and my research, we have never come upon the term depleted uranium. Williams has done a great deal of the legwork. He's a constant monitor. He's been a constant monitor of the war in Afghanistan since the 7th of October, but he's a constant monitor of the websites also. But what it boils down to is that when these weapons burn, when the depleted uranium burns, that is, it's transformed into microscopic, non-soluble, ceramic-like particles, which are inhalable. And when they're inhaled into the lungs, they sit in the lung tissue, and then they irradiate the body, and they're a source of internal radiation, and needless to say, ultimately, they're lethal.
So the Pentagon is not admitting thus far to the use of depleted uranium in these much larger weapons with, as you said, up to more than a ton of depleted uranium.
No. In fact, in December, there was an article in the New York Times about the new movement in the arsenal in the United States and the creation of these penetrating weapons and so on. And this was, I suspect, to make the public aware that this is happening and soften up public opinion. On the other hand, what they said, for example, that they gave instances of certain weapons that they said were under study or that had passed into prototype and would be going into production, these we know from the manufacturers' websites are already on sale and have been purchased in large numbers. But they don't mention depleted uranium. They simply speak about the amazing penetrating capacity of them. Now, there has to be something that's doing this, and it is essentially the depleted uranium. And it could conceivably be tungsten or some alloy of tungsten, but again, the tungsten won't burn once it's penetrated and it's down in what the websites call the void. These things go through 30, 40 meters, you may as well say 30, 40 yards of rock or whatever. The penetration is measured by a computer that's included in the missile, and when it reaches the void or when it simply attains an established depth, then the detonator sets fire to the depleted uranium, and it goes off. And again, this is what's burning. Tungsten simply won't do this. And the whole system of missiles in the United States has been upgraded since 1997 so that the conventional warheads can be and are replaced by depleted uranium warheads now.
In comparing what was used in the previous conflicts in Iraq and Yugoslavia and what we may be seeing used in the field right now in Afghanistan, what's the magnitude of increase of use, if you could quantify it for us?
Well, in southern Iraq, they figured it was 310 tons, maybe more. The Laca Foundation, which is based in Amsterdam and which has done a great deal of work on radioactive contamination, the nuclear question, and so on, sent people over in 1998 to do samplings and test them, then in function of the time that had passed and what the stuff had been exposed to, how it could have been dispersed. And they came to the conclusion that it had to be at least 800 tons. Now, the Center for Defense Information was publishing a daily tally of the weapons that were used in the bombing in Afghanistan up until the first week of December. So we've got what should be a close to accurate and complete record of what was dropped during the first 2 months. based on that, Williams made the assessment that it had to be at least 500 tons of DU. Probably 1,000 would be much closer to reality. But after that, the bombing intensified tremendously, also the use of the big missiles. And so Williams and myself since then would figure that up until now that the figure is probably closer to 3,000 tons. And so you can compare this to 800 tons in Iraq and maybe then 310 or so that the Pentagon has admitted to using, in an order of magnitude of 10.
So what is your fear from the people we spoke to in writing this article about the health consequences for the civilians living in Afghanistan and for the combatants who were inhaling the dust from these DU munitions?
Well, Williams is an occupational psychologist, which is how he started to get involved in this. And his recommendation is that, for example, I opened the article with a quote from him, "The immediate concern for medical professionals, for employees of aid organizations, and for employers of other expatriate personnel in the field remains the threat of extensive DU contamination in Afghanistan." He thinks it's a very serious threat, and that is just the immediate concern. Now, further than that, there are the local people who have to live there. A lot of this has been used on the mountains of along the border of Afghanistan with Pakistan. This is the watershed area for the Indus Valley. And it is the Indus Valley that provides the water for the whole of the agriculture of Pakistan, which is the one real wealth of Pakistan. And what this means is that in the long run, this whole area, the whole agricultural, most of the agricultural productivity of Pakistan and most of the mountains were permanently contaminated. There's also the question of the contamination of the cities where this was used, such as Kandahar, Mazar-i-Sharif, and Kabul, for example, where they were bombing targets right there in the cities. And they were obviously using missiles, and in missiles of great penetrating quality. So these areas would be permanently contaminated also. And so Williams said it, one in the long run, would have to envision a evacuation of these areas. And I closed the article with a short anecdote about the Jefferson Proving Ground in Jefferson County, Indiana. The Pentagon has more or less realized it's impossible to clean this up. This is where they used to test the anti-tank penetrator rounds. And the talk now is simply to close it off forever and turn it into a national sacrifice zone. So as to what that leaves for Iraq and Baghdad, Kosovo, and Afghanistan, Pakistan, you can only imagine.
That was Robert James Parson, whose article, "The Big Lie About Clean Wars, The Reality of Depleted Uranium," appeared in the March edition of the French publication Le Monde Diplomatique. For more information, visit the Military Toxics Project website at www.miltoxproj.org. For decades, the U.S. government and American-based corporate media outlets have either ignored or relegated issues facing the African continent to the back pages. While there are exceptions, such as the struggle against apartheid in South Africa or the current dispute over elections in Zimbabwe, American citizens know very little about more pressing concerns like the continent's deadly AIDS pandemic, ongoing violent conflicts, and worsening poverty. The group Africa Action has recently released its annual summary of issues titled Africa Policy Outlook 2002, where a range of important issues facing the people of Africa are examined. Among these are the struggle to gain access to affordable medicines to treat Africa's exploding population that have contracted HIV or AIDS, the increasing number of nations unable to make progress in development due to a suffocating burden of debt to the World Bank, and deadly conflicts that still rage on or remain unresolved in Angola, Burundi, the Sudan, and Congo. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sally Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action, who assesses the distressing set of problems challenging the people of the African continent.
Well, without a doubt, the major challenge in Africa, the major crisis, is also very much a global crisis, and that is the HIV/AIDS pandemic. Because whether we measure it by the numbers of people killed or nations wounded, whether we measure it in terms of economies upended or families crushed, the AIDS pandemic is actually a deadlier global threat than that posed by organized terrorist groups. And yet no one is making the logical conclusion that the war on AIDS is in fact more important than the war on terrorism. And so we're trying to emphasize very much the need to give urgent attention to the HIV/AIDS pandemic in Africa, to recognize that this is the worst human plague that we've seen in an entire recorded history. But the resources just aren't there. The rich countries have failed to have a sense of responsibility for what is indeed a global threat. AIDS knows no borders. It does not discriminate by geography, ideology, religion, gender. But the fact of the matter is, at present, Africa is the epicenter of this pandemic, and we believe strongly for that reason. That is why the Western wealthy nations have failed to act and failed to provide the kind of financing necessary to defeat the pandemic, which we believe is in fact defeatable. But aside from this massive public health crisis, we think it's important for policymakers to try and pay attention to and support in meaningful ways efforts to resolve some of Africa's long-standing conflicts, particularly three conflicts that cut across the center of the continent from the Red Sea to the Atlantic Ocean, and that is the war in Sudan, which is in fact the longest-running war in the world today. The country haven't been at war since independence, literally, in 1955, with one brief respite in the 70s. And neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, of course, where you have in excess of eight African countries involved in a war that developed following the overthrow and death of Mobutu Sese Seko, the U.S. client dictator during the Cold War years. And neighboring that, a very large country, of course, is Angola, where that conflict has gone on since independence as well in 1976, and where the recent death of Jonas Savimbi, another U.S. client during the Cold War, his recent death just several weeks ago in fighting, removes one of the major obstacles to peace in that country. And so in Angola, in Congo, and in Sudan, there are possibilities for promoting a peaceful resolution of these conflicts, and we think that's essential to creating the kind of stability and order for citizens of these countries to create governments that are representative of their interests and that promote respect for human rights and development in those countries.
As we conclude, Sally Booker, why should people in the United States be concerned with the welfare of our brothers and sisters in Africa, given all that's going on in the world, the wars, you know, concern about our economic recession here at home? Why should people give a hoot?
Well, I think quite simply it's because we're all part of the same human cloth, the same human fabric, and that whatever happens in Africa does have implications for the rest of the world, whether it's positive or negative. So whether it's the growth and spread of the HIV/AIDS pandemic, that has real negative consequences for the public health of people throughout the world. And it should be defeated in Africa. It shouldn't have to wait until it's having a greater impact in countries deemed economically important to the United States before the U.S. starts to address this problem. Same with terrorism, in a way. You will recall, with the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 98, it was mainly Africans who were killed. And several hundred at that. And yet there were no calls at that time for a war against terrorism. There was no real effort to help African countries deal with their insecurities against organized terrorism. And then you see the attacks in September 11th in New York and realize that that's one of the consequences of failing to cooperate and work with Africans to address what are essentially global threats. So I think, you know, it's partly self-interest that we all live in this same neighborhood, and you can't just ignore the challenges or dilemmas that your neighbors feel, but also because the United States in many ways owes great debts to Africa. This is a country of African descent as well as European descent. We have taken so much from Africa over the centuries in terms of human resources and natural resources, and I think we have a historical obligation to help correct those injustices.
That was Sally Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action. Contact the group by calling area code 202-546-7961 or read the Africa Policy Outlook 2002 report online at www.africaaction.org. The ratification of the North American Free Trade Agreement 10 years ago united Canada, the United States, and Mexico in a continental trading bloc. Opponents of NAFTA focused attention on labor and environmental concerns, but in the end these areas were relegated to weak side agreements with no mechanism for enforcement. But one important provision, known as Chapter 11, escaped the notice of many critics. Chapter 11 gives corporations unprecedented power over governments because it spells out the terms under which investors, that is, multinational corporations, must be compensated for losses incurred by expropriation through government action. But the wording is so broad that it's been interpreted to mean corporations will be compensated for loss of profit for any reason, including the enforcement of health and safety regulations. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dan Seligman, director of the Sierra Club's trade program. He discusses the impact Chapter 11 has already had on trade among NAFTA partners and the danger of a Chapter 11-type provision being included in the much larger free trade area of the Americas, a hemispheric-wide treaty now being negotiated.
Chapter 11 of NAFTA was supposed to promote foreign investment by U.S. companies abroad. But the way it does it is it gives private companies the right to sue governments if the government takes action in of any sort, really, that happens to interfere with the company's profits. The thought was that these provisions would be used if a government, say, seized a company's asset by sending in the army. But really, the rules are much broader, actually allowing companies to sue governments if pollution laws reduce profits, if the government perhaps raises taxes, if a jury finds that the company was guilty of fraud. Basic government functions can now be challenged by corporations through these rules.
And have there been cases where it has happened?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Can you give an example of one and what
Sure.
the resolution was?
Well, in California, the governor a couple years back decided to phase out a toxic gas additive called MTBE. The methanol in MTBE is made by a Canadian company called the Methanex Corporation. When the phase-out was announced, Methanex sued the United States for $1 billion, alleging that it had suffered damage to its business because of California's effort to make sure its water was safe to drink. That case is still pending, but the shocking thing about it is that it's being heard at all. A NAFTA tribunal is meeting to decide whether or not U.S. taxpayers have to pay $1 billion because the governor of California was trying to have clean water and regulate a dangerous product in the marketplace. Generally, U.S. courts wouldn't even hear such a case. It's pretty much assumed that governments can regulate dangerous products, but that really is no longer the case when it comes to NAFTA. There is now the potential for enormous liability and great cost to taxpayers should government try to step in and protect citizens.
What's the connection, if any, with the environmental side agreements to NAFTA?
Well, actually, there's no real connection at all. The environmental side agreements created a commission that's now located up in Canada with power to oversee the enforcement of environmental laws in the three NAFTA countries, but really that commission has no enforcement teeth. It really can't make anything happen in the real world. In stark contrast, NAFTA created a binding dispute mechanism by which private companies can go and win cash damages from governments if any of their businesses are affected by normal government regulation. So the environment got really a lot of eyewash in NAFTA. Private corporations got enormous new powers to
beat up on governments that are trying to protect the public interest.
NAFTA has been in existence for, I guess, about 8 years.
Hmm.
And now the FTAA, Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, is being discussed. There's a process by which all the countries of the Western Hemisphere, I guess, except Cuba, are going to be talking about, you know, dropping trade barriers. Is there potential for the same or a similar agreement to end up in FTAA?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Bush administration intends to expand NAFTA's investor provisions throughout the Americas. And what's more, it's very likely that these same investor lawsuit provisions could be expanded globally through the WTO eventually. Congress has two opportunities to affect these decisions. One is when it grants trade negotiating authority, otherwise known as fast track, to the president. And the second opportunity is when a trade deal is brought back under the fast track rules for an up or down vote that makes it effective as law in the United States. And the Senate is currently debating fast track legislation. We expect a vote on that legislation in early April. And as written, the fast-track legislation before the Senate calls for an aggressive expansion of the NAFTA-style investor rules, not only throughout the hemisphere, but potentially worldwide.
What specifically is the Sierra Club and many, if you know, of any other environmental organizations doing to try to counteract this?
Our only real leverage point is in Congress with respect to fast-track legislation. So we are right now trying to work with Senator Kerry to amend that fast-track bill so that it doesn't permit the U.S. trade rep to develop these NAFTA investor provisions in future trade deals. Because of the politics of the Senate, we stand very little chance of actually defeating fast-track, and so we're trying to fix it around certain core issues like these investment lawsuits, and Senator Kerry is leading the charge on that.
That was Dan Seligman of the Sierra Club's trade program. For more information, call the Sierra Club at area code 202-675-2387 or visit the group's website at www.sierraclub.org/trade. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.